Good morning, everyone. So we're reading in book two, the book of the Traveler of the Worlds. And last week we started on canto five, the Godheads of the Little Life. I think we read the first three sections, and then we went back to the beginning to look in more detail. And I think we stopped on page 152 at line 46. When Aspapati wants to see beyond the surface of these kingdoms of the little life, which we read about in the previous canto, he sees a world that seems to be smothered in a kind of mist, and he sends through that mist a concentrated beam of vision, and it's like a searchlight in the darkness. Suddenly appear all kinds of beings and creatures there, an elfin brood, an elemental kind. They look in folk knowledge, they know about these little creatures, these imps and goblins and fairies and genii, no? So they are all there somehow in our subtle atmosphere. Mother has said once, you know, we look out and we look up to the beautiful blue sky, but if we could see all the little beings that are swarming there, that would not be such a beautiful picture. He says these beings are ignorant and dangerous. Their wills are armed with a certain amount of power. Half animal, half god, their mood, their shape. Some of them even are divine beings who have got lost and trapped in the dust of time. And they are sending their suggestions to us all the time. So I think that's where we started. You would read, Ramnarayan?
Out of the grayness of a dim background, their whispers come, an inarticulate force. Awake in mind, an echoing thought or word, to their sting of impulse, the heart's sanction draw, and in that little nature do their work, and fill its powers and creatures with unease. Its seed of joy they curse with sorrow's fruit, put out with error's breath its scanty lights, and turn its surface truths to falsehood's ends. Its small emotions spur, its passions drive to the abyss, or through the and mire. Or else with a board of hard, dry lusts they prick, while jogs on devious ways that nowhere lead, life's cart finding no issue from ignorance. To sport with good and evil is their law, luring to failure and meaningless success. All models they corrupt, all measures cheat, make knowledge a poison, virtue a pattern dull, and lead the endless cycles of desire through semblances of sad or happy chance to an inescapable fatality.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask or share anything about this passage? That's what's going on behind the fair surface of our life, of our little life. He will tell us a little bit more about how they get their power as we read on.
He's saying they awake in the mind, and their sting draws the heart's sanction, and in that little nature do their work.
So we're reading about the little life. So it's the lower life that's just emerging from the dominance of matter and half-developed life. Mind is only just starting to be an influence, no? So the atmosphere around us is full of these little beings and their suggestions, and we are not aware of them. So it's rather easy for their suggestions to pop into our minds, and we don't notice even that they're coming, or we don't notice where they're coming from. Just some impulse or thought suddenly is there, and if the heart sanctions and says, oh yes, yeah, then we will follow it. I think one of the reasons that Sri Aurobindo is devoting so many lines and pages to this topic of the little life, it's because we need to be aware that there's this level. It's an evolutionary level. It has a place in the Earth's development. It has a place. We are all carrying something of it within us. And it's good to be aware that these influences are around. And we don't, that might make us a little bit careful about responding or getting carried away by every thought or feeling that comes into us.
Are they related to hostile forces?
Well, of course, they are small hostile forces. Yeah. I think where have they come from? Perhaps he will speak about that. So, you know, in our lives, we get angry, we get upset, we get anxious and fearful. And these little beings are like small disintegrated bits of all that trouble that's in us. And they're just floating around in the atmosphere. It may even happen, you know, when the soul leaves the body, the vital being disintegrates, then all these little bits are left. So here in India, people are very careful to try to keep away from a dead body that's being disposed of, you know. They don't want to feel the atmosphere of these beings.
They have around 12 days of purification, no? On the first day, second day, seventh day,
yeah,
day, like that.
To purify the atmosphere, no?
Mm. Mm. I remember mother was telling that people come to her, and what she sees around their head, like a worms around their head, especially the sexual feelings are very strong.
Mm.
And then she does, what she does is that she uses like a flash and act on. That's what she does.
To dissolve them, those formations, yes. Yes, we're all carrying these kind of things around. And of course that's one of the great blessings, that to know the name of Mother and Sri Aurobindo, the names of Mother and Sri Aurobindo, and we are blessed to live here where their influence is at work. But sensitive people go from here into the ordinary world, and they feel the difference. No?
Do not the hostile forces take more interest in people who are making progress spiritually?
Yeah.
Well, of course, actively adverse forces, they do that.
Yes.
But these are very mischievous little beings. They just do what they do. No? It's when we come to a higher level of life that these really very dangerous adverse forces come.
Your mind mentalizes the unconscious.
Yes.
And Mother said, bien, tout ça prêt. He offered everything to the divine. Mother Yav, at this moment in the city, some attack in his body. And he offered, à toi, Seigneur, à toi, Seigneur.
Yes. So if we become aware of these things, we can offer them. Mm. And we can ask for protection. We should be asking for protection routinely, all the time. No? Yes. So they don't lead us to any good, these small, nasty impulses.
The golden heart drive us.
Yeah, they're pricking you to do this and that and the other. To make a goad, you know, to make something that they can poke you with. It all gets densified. You'll read? Top of the page, 153.
All day their influence is enacted there. nor there alone is their empire or their role. Wherever our soulless minds and guideless lives, and in a small body self is all that counts. Wherever love and light and largeness lack, these crooked fashioners take up their task. To all half-conscious worlds they extend their reign. Here too these goblins drive our human hearts. Our nature's twilight is their lurking place. Here too the darkened primitive heart obeys the veiled suggestions of a hidden mind that dogs our knowledge with misleading light and stands between us and the truth that says. It speaks to us with the voices of the night, our darkened lives to greater darkness move. Our seekings listen to calamitous hopes. A structure of unseen thoughts is built, and reason used by an irrational force.
Thank you. So in that realm of the little life, which Asvapati is exploring now, everything is enacted by the influence of these small beings. No? But not only there, not there alone is their empire or their role. Wherever there are soulless minds and guideless lives, and in a small body self is all that counts, wherever love and light and largeness lack, where those things are missing, these crooked fashioners take up their task. They're crooked, they distort things. That's their work. And they extend their rule to all half-conscious worlds, including our own. Here too, these godlings, these little divinities, they drive our human hearts, our nature's twilight, the areas of ourselves that we can't see very clearly. That's where they hide. Perhaps this is what part of what the mother meant when she says you mentalize your unconsciousness. No, your those little beings are there. They influence, and then we make it into a thought. We give it a form and an intention and a purpose. No? So here too, the part of our heart which is still dark and primitive, it obeys the veiled suggestions. Behind these little beings, there's a hidden mind, with a capital M. And that's a mind that's really something hostile. It's something that's following all our attempts at knowledge with misleading light. It stands between us and the truth that saves. A few cantos on, Shobindo will show us this hidden mind which speaks to us with the voices of the night. Our lives are already twilight or darkened, but those suggestions move us to greater darkness. Our seekings, our desires and aspirations, they listen to calamitous hopes. To hopes and suggestions that can really lead us to disaster. That mind builds up a structure of unseeing thoughts. They may be convincing, but they are missing most of the picture. And that mind uses reason, although itself it is an irrational force. So how can all that affect us here? No. This is something that's happening, and these beings exist in this realm of little mind. How do they come to us here and affect us here? Would you? Yes. Sorry, what is the purpose of what? Rather than purpose, I would like to say place. No, these are beings and entities that get formed in the process of our development, the development of life out of matter. when everything's still dominated by matter, life begins to stir. And we saw that even on the physical level, the first life can be something quite unpleasant, ferments and slimes and molds and bacteria and viruses and all things like that. So it's the same on the psychological level. All these tiny, ignorant wills, they have some life power. And if they are not enlightened, if they're not brought up into the light, then this is what they do. They play around in the mud and the darkness of human nature. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so they're also part of the creation.
They are part of the creation, yes, a level. And it's a level which has to be purified. And if we want to do yoga, I think Sri Aurobindo says this is the most important part to purify first. He calls it the psychic prana. He says that's such an influential part of our lives. And if we really want to move to a higher consciousness, we have to become aware of all this and offer it to the light and see that we have enough consciousness not to get influenced by all this. I was just reading that chapter in Synthesis of Yoga the other day. So all this can happen also because of what comes next. Would you read?
This birth is not known to our teacher and nurse. The powers of all the worlds have entered here. In their own fields, they follow the wheel of law and cherish the safety of the settled tongue. On earth, out of their changeless orbit fallen, their lords have lost their fixed form on things. Into a creative chaos, they are cast. Where all asks order but is driven by chance. Strangers to earth nature, they must learn earth's way. Aliens or opposites, they must unite. They work in battle and with pain agree. These join, those part, all parts and joints believe. But never can be known and truly live till all have found their divine harmony. Our life's uncertain way winds circling on. Our mind's unquiet search asks always light, till they have learned their secret in their souls. In the light of the timeless and the stateless hope, in the joy of the eternal soul and one.
Let's pause there. So this is very, very interesting, no? Here we are on earth, we know something about earth nature and the way it works, not much, but something. But we're not only being taught and nursed by the earth. Powers of all the worlds can enter here and influence us and teach us and nurse us. That's the difference between earth and all the other worlds. The other worlds are typal worlds. They just are. They're fixed. They don't progress, they don't evolve. Each of them represents a level of universal development. So in their own fields, they just follow the law of that field. They cherish the safety of a settled type. That's how they are, that's their world, that's what it's like. Yes, or here it's the little life, the lower levels of life that he's talking about. Yes, so of course they have entrance here. But here they don't have that safety of the way things are done in their own world, which is fixed, which doesn't change. Here they're thrown into the law of earth, which is a law of creative chaos where everything influences everything else. Everything needs and asks for order, but our world is driven by the rule of chance, of randomness, and they are strangers to earth nature. They have to learn earth's ways. And an important aspect of earth's ways is that all the opposites and differences, they have to learn to live together, to harmonize. No? So these all these different tendencies are supposed to unite. It's difficult for them to unite and harmonize. So they work and battle, and with difficulty they agree, they join, they part again. Everything parts and joins anew. We can see this going on all around us in Auroville every day. But never can we know and truly live till all these tendencies have found their divine harmony. Our life's uncertain way winds round and round in circles, but hopefully it's an upward moving spiral. Our mind's unquiet search is always asking for more light, more understanding. And this goes on until all these different tendencies from all the different planes of existence have learned their secret by coming in contact with their source, their true source, in the light of the timeless and its spaceless home, in the joy of the eternal soul and one. That's where it's all going to, a fulfillment for all these different planes of existence, these different levels of being. But in the meantime, it's a kind of creative chaos.
It seems a sort of strange spelling for soul.
There's one eternal, only one. He is soul, the alone, Sri Aurobindo often puts him with a capital A. Yeah.
These are the powers of all the worlds.
Mm. All the worlds, all the planes of existence.
So that's why I'm asking.
Yeah. Now we're in the... that's what Asvapati is exploring. No, he started from the world of matter. He's explored the world of the subtle physical matter, and now he's in the worlds of the lowest level of life. We will see a little bit higher as we go on. And he has seen somehow the physical development of life from those very simplest life forms to the animal creation, and then to the beginning of some emergence of vital mind. That's what we saw in the previous canto. There were these three levels. But he wants to see the powers that are working below the surface. And the first thing he sees is all these little entities. And they can extend their rule to all half-conscious realms, including our own Earth.
The sentence, liner 90, on Earth, out of their changeless or deep home, there is gap. Can you explain this sentence and put it in the right way?
Sorry, I've got lost. No. Yes, what happens, these beings come from their typal worlds, they enter our world, and then they're no longer protected by their law. No?
So their law is
not kept? No, they keep it. They keep their law, but their fixed form of things that they're used to in their own world is lost here. Here they have to adapt to Earth existence. They're thrown into this creative chaos where they're asked to adapt to everything around them. It's a bit like us when we first come to Auroville, to India, out of a culture that we've grown up in and been to school in, and somehow to a certain extent succeeded in. The first thing that happens to us here is that all those things we thought that we knew get challenged, sometimes quite brutally. No? And here we are cast into this creative chaos, and we all have to learn to unite, no?
These beings are now then subject to transformation, change.
If they come into the earth atmosphere, they can become transformed, yes.
Then they are lucky to come here.
Yes, they're lucky, but it might be difficult for us, you know, if there are too many of them at one time.
Good that you are connecting to all of the life, it makes love, helps us to understand. When you said that when we come to certain belief system or whatever, and we are challenged here, do we need to accept the challenge or we need to stand? If we think that this is not the spirit of all of it, but it is the collective consciousness which is challenging us, should we stand and say that look like that?
I always have this problem with savitri, because people want to draw lessons from it, make it prescriptive. I find that savitri is not prescriptive, it is descriptive. Sri Aurobindo is describing for us how psychologically things are and how they work. So that comes to us as knowledge. We can absorb this as knowledge. But we can't, I think we can't draw moral precepts either for ourselves or for other people that this means that you have to do this, that or the other. And this somehow, the consciousness within, the soul, the aspiration, has to see what it can make out of this this knowledge. And here especially where transformation is going on, there are no fixed rules. There are guidelines and warnings perhaps. He shows us things that we have to be careful of, but I don't think we can draw any rules. Does that make sense to you? At least I feel we have to be very careful about that. Yes.
We as human beings have the capacity of finding our own heart and move from there.
Yes.
But these beings seem not
seem to be unsouled.
Right.
Yes. There's no psychic influence,
right,
perhaps.
So is there
maybe that's why they come to Earth, as Ramnarayan suggested. Maybe they come here to be transformed.
Can they be transformed without a soul?
Huh?
Yeah, right, that's basically
No, I don't know.
But if they are soulless, how can they find the source?
Our emotions.
I don't know the answers to these questions. Let's see what he shows us. But now we still have these last lines on page 154 to read before the break. No? That's what they are here for on Earth. They have to learn their secret in their source, and that means in the light of the timeless and the eternal. But now, who's reading next? Don.
But now the light supreme is far away. Our conscious life obeys the inconscious laws to ignorant purposes and blind desires. Our hearts are moved by an ambiguous force. Even our mind's conquests wear a battered crown. A slowly changing order binds our will. This is our doom until our souls are free. A mighty hand then rolls mind's firmaments back. Infinity takes up the finite's acts, and nature steps into the eternal light. Then only ends this dream of nether life.
Of lower life. So some process is going on here on Earth until our souls are free, and then all this mind, all these acts of the finite, everything's changed.
I have already difficulties with this sentence. Our conscious life obeys the inconscious law.
You're asking about it?
Yeah.
Well, here we are we compared with plants and lower animals, we have a relatively conscious life, but like all other earth creatures, we have to obey the laws of matter most of the time. The mind and the heart, the soul and the spirit can help us become free from that. The soul can become free, and then everything can change. But at the moment, we feel very much dominated by the laws of the inconscient, the laws of physics, the laws of even the lower levels of psychology. We are still ruling our nature.
In the Sanat Sivana 985, and reason used by irrational force.
Yeah, there he's speaking about a hidden mind. That's really a hostile force, as you were suggesting, no? And that makes use of our God-given power of reason, which to persuade us to do things that are that we shouldn't do, that are irrational. And that force uses reason, but it is not rational. It is a hostile will.
But it makes it sound reasonable.
Yeah, that's happening to us all the time, no? Yeah, we justify to ourselves or something in us justifies doing things, leads us to these calamitous hopes, no? Trying to fulfill them. So here he's saying it's a long process until this dream of the nether life, what he's outlining to us now, or has been, of the lower life, until that can be transformed, until that will come to an end. Now he's going to look at things from another angle.
This is a kind of chemical process, chemical reaction, no? Gum and they mix and they get transformed, they affect the chains.
One can make that analogy, yeah, I think so, yes.
Sometimes they behave like catalysts, their presence is there, but accelerates or slows down the process, something like that.
But I think for it to be, can we say purifying or uplifting, there needs to be some conscious will and maybe the action of grace. You'll read.
At the outset of this enigmatic world, which seems at once an enormous great machine and a slow unmasking of the spirit in things, in this revolving chamber without walls, in which a God sits impassive everywhere, as if unknown to himself and by us unseen, in a miracle of inconscient secrecy. Yet is all here his action and his will. In this whirl and sprawl through infinite vacancy, the spirit became matter and lay in the world, a body sleeping without sense or soul, a mass phenomenon of visible shapes, supported by the silence of the void, appeared in the internal consciousness and seemed an outworld, an insensible world. There was none there to see and none to feel, only the miraculous inconscient, a subtle wizard skilled, was at its task, inventing ways for magical results, managing creations, marvelous advice, marking mechanically done wisdom's points, using the untaught, inevitable idea. It did the works of God's intelligence, or wrote the will of some supreme unknown.
Thank you. This is a picture of the beginning of our world. No? At the outset, at the beginning of this enigmatic world, this puzzling, mysterious world, which seems to be two things at once. On one hand, a just enormous brute machine working automatically, but at the same time, it does seem to be a slow unmasking, a slow revelation of the spirit in things. This revolving chamber, the universe going round and round, but it has no walls. No? In this chamber, God is sitting everywhere, impassive. He doesn't seem to react to anything. It seems as if he's unknown even to himself. And we don't see him, no? There he's sitting there in a miracle of inconscient secrecy. And yet everything here is his action and his will. I think the editors have made a mistake there, and there shouldn't be a full stop after will. There should be a comma. In this whirl and sprawl through infinite vacancy, that's a way of seeing the universe. Sprawling matter, whirling in this unlimited emptiness. In this revolving chamber, the spirit became matter and lay in the whirl, a body sleeping without sense or soul. No senses, no soul. That seems to be the outset, the beginning of this world of ours, one way of seeing it. So then, this mass phenomenon of visible shapes appeared in the eternal consciousness, supported by the silence of the emptiness. This is what the physicists tell us, no? That at the beginning, at the outset of this enigmatic world, there was a kind of explosion. There was no matter as such. There were no forms as such. That took time to appear. No? But eventually, these visible shapes did appear, and that gives us this seeming of an outward world without senses, without the capacity for sensation. There was a physical world, a material world, but there was no one to see it, no one to feel. But it seems within it, the miraculous inconscient, without consciousness, without senses, was doing its amazing task like an enchanter, a subtle wizard, skilled, inventing ways for magical results, managing creation's marvelous device, all the tricks and that allow this material universe to have developed. It seems like there's an inconscient power which was marking mechanically certain points, dumb wisdom's points, was using an idea, a concept, unthought but inevitable. It's doing the works of God's intelligence and working out the will of some supreme unknown. Some unknown existence must have had that idea, that unthought, inevitable idea. And the inconscience, whatever it is, seems to be working out the will of that unknown quantity, whatever it is. Perhaps this is what the Upanishads call the Brahman. Fanny, what do you read? We're at the top of page 155, second line, still consciousness.
Still consciousness was hidden in nature's womb. Unfelt was the bliss whose rapture dreamed the world. Being was an inert substance driven by force. At first was only an etheric space. Its huge vibrations circled round and round, housing some unconceived initiative, upheld by a supreme original breath. Expansion and contraction's mystic act created touch and fiction in the void. Into abstract emptiness brought clash and class, parent of an expanding universe in a matrix of disintegrated force
by spending it conserved an endless sun on the path of space, it kindled a viewless fire that, scattering worlds as one might scatter seeds, whirled out the luminous order of the stars. An ocean of electric energy formlessly formed its strange wave particles, constructing by their dance their solid scheme, its mightiness in the atom's sharp rest. Masses were forged of veined and visible shapes. Light flung the photon's swift revealing spark and showed in the minuteness of its flash image this cosmos of apparent things.
Thank you. And then he seems to tell the story in another way, and the way of the elements, the five elements, no? That everything starts with an etheric space, an emptiness full of ether. And in that space, there are vibrations circling round and round. There seems to be some initiative, some starting point, but maybe unconceived. Where has it come from? So these huge vibrations circling round and round and supported by a supreme original breath which breathes in and out, that creates touch and friction in the emptiness, clash and clasp. So this movement of vibrations, expansion and contraction, this gives birth to an expanding universe in a matrix of disintegrating force. A matrix is a mother, it's a womb, but here it must be a framework, that there's this circling and vibrations and expanding and contraction. But the framework for all this is disintegration, what the physicists call entropy. The laws of thermodynamics which the physicists give us are very confusing, actually. No? They say everything's disintegrating, but still, at the same time, we see that here and there things are not disintegrating. They are coming together and getting more and more complex. So something of that is expressed here by spending, by this spending of energy. Still, an endless sum is conserved. Matter and energy cannot be created or destroyed, we are told. The sum of everything stays the same. But somehow that movement and that friction in the hearth of space, a hearth is a place where you light a fire, a viewless fire is lit, an invisible fire. And that fire, that fire force, that force of energy, scatters worlds, whirling out the luminous order of the star. The stars appear as fires in the universe. No? And we are told that all the matter that we know has actually been produced in the heart of stars. No? And on a subtler level, all this is happening in an ocean of electric energy, which is somehow formlessly forming these paradoxical wave particles, which the present-day physicists see as the basis of everything. Sometimes they are like behave like waves, sometimes they behave like particles. But anyway, by their dance, by their movement, they construct somehow this solid scheme that we live in. The mightiness, the force of that electric energy is shut up in the atom. So in this way, masses were formed, or at least, if not actually formed, they appeared, they seem to appear, they are feigned and visible shapes. What we see as visible shapes may not really exist as visible shapes, but at least we see them like that. And light is the movement of photons, also particles or wave particles. When light appears, then we can see this cosmos of apparent things. It's a very poetic way of expressing one view of the creation of the universe. Sorry? I don't know how much physics he studied. I know that he studied the Upanishadic physics. There's a very, very interesting essay, and there's his conversations to Pavitra, who was a physicist, about the three forms of fire and so on.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who will read next? Jocelyn. You listen, we will hear Mother reading these lines. She laughs. She almost laughs. Read it again.
First, I've been made.
Thank you. So Sri Aurobindo has given us this description, but he doesn't actually sanction it. He says, this is how it seems to have happened to the daring mind of man, and we base our thought, our own thought, our power of thought as the arbiter of truth. And we're very much influenced by our personal vision. We tend to consider it as impersonal fact. We rely, particularly the materialists rely, on our erring senses and our instruments, the tools that we make to extend our senses. These are the witnesses of an objective world for the mind of man. And Sri Aurobindo says we have to work out this tangible riddle of life in this doubtful light, We have to use our erring senses and our erring reason to seize on truth and slowly separate the face that is behind and the veil which is veiling it from us. If we don't do that, if we don't take up this attempt to understand the physical world through our senses and our instruments and our reason, the alternative is that we put aside any faith in the power of our mind and our senses, and we think that all this is just a bright body of ignorance, and everything that is fashioned here is actually illusory. And everything here is the unwelcome jest, the joke of a deceiving force deliberately deluding us, a parable of Maya, of illusion and her power. However it has happened, this universe, this vast perpetual motion, caught and held in the mysterious and unchanging change of the persistent movement we call time. Time is really a mystery if we try to understand it. No, we just only have to accept that this movement of time goes on, this persistent movement, ever renewing its recurrent beat. There seem to be repetitions. Things go round and round in the giving the appearance of a flow, a fixed flow. These static objects in the cosmic dance, which turn out to be just energy repeating itself round and round, prolonged by the spirit of the brooding void, the emptiness perpetuates all this. All this perpetual motion awaited, it's waiting for life and sense and waking mind, the material universe before the emergence of life. So a little the dreamer changed his pose of stone. Some change, perhaps, in the matter, in the world of matter. But then something does change. Jean-Yves, would you read?
But when in conscience preparous work was done, and chance coerced by fixed immutable laws, a scene was set on ancient conscious plane. Then stirred the spirit's new immobile sea. The force from sea rolled dampened slowly out. A dream of living woke in matter's heart. The will to leave move in conscious dust, a freak of living startled vague time. Ephemeral in a blank eternity, infinitesimal in a dead infinite. Circular breath quickened dead matter's form. The world set rhythm changed with conscious cry. The serpent power tuned in sensible force. Islands of a living dotted by the space. And germs of living formed in forms. A life was born that followed matter's law, ignorant of the motives of its steps, ever inconstant, yet forever the same, it repeating the paradox that gave it birth, its restless and unstable stability, recurred incessantly in the flow of time and purposeful movements in unthinking form. Betray the heavens of an imprisoned will. Waking and sleep lay locked in neutral arms. Helpless and indistinct came pleasure and pain, trembling with the first faint dream.
Thank you. This is another way of seeing the emergence of life from matter. No? Very beautiful description. First, the inconscient has to prepare everything. No? But then, this hidden force emerges, a will to live, moved the inconscient's dusk. A freak of living, startled vacant time. It doesn't last long, ephemeral, in a blank eternity, infinitesimal, tiny, in a dead infinite. But still, a subtler breath has quickened, has brought to life dead matter's forms. The world's set rhythm changed to a conscious cry. With the very first emergence of life, consciousness emerges. Consciousness expressed in movement. A serpent power, a power of life, of vitality, matches, twinned the insensible force of material force. And little islands of living began to appear. And this life has to follow the law of matter. That's what we saw in the previous canto. But still, it keeps emerging more and more, and purposeful movements appear in unthinking forms. And the fact that that happens, he says, betrayed the heavings of an imprisoned will. Imprisoned in matter is a will to move and live and become conscious. Still there's this mingling of waking and sleep, but helpless and indistinct emerged pleasure and pain. These are twins who are trembling with the first faint thrills of a world soul in the world of matter. I think that's a good place to stop for today.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.